Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Family Business Radio. It is 1 p.m. on Thursday, so this is where you will find us each and every week. And, you know, through Family Business Radio, we are showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am co-host of the show, Pat Rombletti from Sage Executive Search.
And I am Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management.
Welcome.
Excited to be here. And today we have yet another very exciting family business topic. You know, Pat, statistics tell us that about 50% of all marriages end in divorce. And we always talk about how over 80% of all businesses are family owned. At some point, you know that these two statistics and the probabilities are going to collide and that there's going to be a family-owned business that's going to face the issue of divorce. You know, given how high these probabilities are, our guest today and the information that she's going to share is really critical for our family business audience.
It sure is. And I would like to welcome our guest, Tamar Fallhaber. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's glad to have you. Tell us a little bit about your background. Are you a Atlanta native, as so few are?
No, I'm not, although I've been here for more than 10 years, so I hear that gives me the privilege of saying that. But yeah. In any event, I'm originally from California, and I went to UCLA Law School there and traveled back here to Georgia where my husband could establish his own family business.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. And tell us a little bit about your practice and your firm.
Okay, I currently work for Vernis & Bolling of Atlanta. They're located all over the Southeast, mainly doing insurance defense type of litigation. But they hired me in the Atlanta office to expand and develop a family law practice. So I practice exclusively in the area of domestic relations, you know, handling divorces and child custody, child support issues, things like that.
Yeah, I noticed that you are particularly do a lot of work with children and that are involved in divorce. Is that correct?
I do. I mean, early on in my legal career, I was able to work with a fantastic attorney in California who specialized in high conflict divorces involving children. So I've got a lot of background in that area. I took classes on child abuse and domestic violence and things of that sort. And, you know, even when I was early on in my legal career, I was thinking, okay, I can see how that, what issues arise in those types of cases. I'd like to see the other end, and worked with an attorney to the stars in Century City and found that there were similar issues no matter what the income level was. And I was happy to be able to contribute in those cases as well based upon my background. But really, that's what got me interested in the area of family law. I approach it in a way that a lot of other attorneys don't, and that is that I really approach each client and find out what their goals are and really how can they help them develop goals for leaving the marriage in such a way that can actually improve their situation in life, really help them focus on what's important, whether it's their kids, whether it's, you know, establishing a new business or something else on their own, and really help them stay focused on their goals for improving the situation, you know, taking a hard situation and really seeing what we can do with it without compromising their values.
Well, today we're talking about a child in a way. For most family business owners, the business is their child. So that'll be a hot topic for us today.
You know, Tamar, I think it's really hard for people to think this way about marriage. But, you know, really looking at kind of a beginning with the end in mind, is that a prudent approach when, you know, people are looking at getting married, especially if there's a sizable family business involved? I mean, what are your thoughts on some of that?
On starting the divorce with the end in mind?
Well, no, starting the marriage with the end in mind, keeping in perspective that, hey, I might be part of a family business, and how do I address that with my spouse, and what legal implications does that have back to the business, God forbid, if I did have to go down the road of a divorce?
You know, I thought a lot about that in preparing for this show, and how do you approach somebody and say, you know, you have a family business, you better enter a prenup when you get married, and how do you approach that issue? And What I realized is that that's not the discussion that you have. It should be a no-brainer. Listen, I've got a family business. We have our protection. We're getting married. You know, I want you to participate. And so we, as a family, we may have to we want you to sign this buy-sell agreement or something to effect so that you can participate in it. And part of that is part of your estate planning, what happens if we die, but also what happens in the event of the divorce, because obviously I'm going to want to continue the family business, but I want you to be paid equitably for it. And so let's plan, you know, it shouldn't be part of the discussion necessarily as to, okay, let's plan for the divorce, but it's the family coming forward with that as an option. But, you know, in starting that discussion here, I think that what we might want to do and what I do with my clients and really picking up on how do you start with the end in mind is educating the audience as to what could happen. You know, starting the conversation with what can you do to prevent things from happening really starts with what things are we preventing? Mm-hmm. What does the law say? What are your rights? And what is the worst thing that can happen? Because, you know, I've done a really good survey of the law and the cases in Georgia especially and found there's a lot of really bad things that can happen in a divorce. And I think that that's something that we should talk about.
Well, start with the law itself. You know, right. Let's give people just an overview. Many, because so few are from the state of Georgia. I myself have been divorced for many years, but I filed my divorce in Massachusetts. So I'm sure that there's not a lot of similarity to the rules and regs here. So,
well, and I was raised in California, and it's a lot different there mm-hmm. too. So the laws in Georgia as it affects. A divorcing family who has a family business affect two very important key aspects. One is dividing property, and the other is establishing income for child support and alimony purposes. So the law on dividing property is, in Georgia, that any asset that is acquired through the efforts of either spouse may be equitably divided as marital property. So a lot of people may think that equitable may be dividing in half, mm-hmm. but that's not what the law is. Equitable means what's fair, and it could be based upon the contributions to the asset, the expectations of the parties during the marriage, the conducts of the parties during the marriage, the needs, the abilities, all sorts of equitable factors goes into that determination. And what distinguishes Georgia from almost every other state is that equitable division of property may be determined by a jury, not just a judge.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of risks involved when we're looking at division of family business. Mm-hmm. Well, and what you should realize is that definition of marital property excludes certain things that you bring into the marriage or inheritance or gifts from a family member or from a third party. That's separate property. That's not equitably divided. But what we see so often, if let's say a spouse, and for practical purposes, let's just say it's the husband, mm-hmm. It participates, owns a family business or a portion stock in the business, and they bring it to the marriage. Mm-hmm. That could be his separate property. But the more that he works at the business and increases the value, that appreciation of that value is acquired during the marriage through his efforts. So it can transform some of that value into marital property subject to equitable division.
And I suppose if you're in front of a jury and you have brought a business to the marriage and your wife has come in and said that I, you know, used to go in every Saturday and check out the books or make sure everything was in order. Now that changes her participation?
It certainly does, certainly because her efforts have also increased the appreciation, if you mm-hmm. can show that, what right. her efforts did. And also if you've been able to establish what the value of the business was at the time of the marriage versus, mm-hmm. At the time of the divorce. And then there's other times when you're actually establishing a business during the marriage, whether, mm-hmm. you know, it's all marital property is subject to equitable division. Right. It could be acquired in one party's name and then transferred to the other party's name. But really it matters is how they, you know, I read this case I thought was wonderful. And just because it shows you what the dangers are. Mm-hmm. And this was an income case. The husband was saying that he didn't have any income when they got divorced. The wife came back and asked for an increase of child support and alimony. He owned a pest control business. Well, it was in his new wife's name, the pest control business. When they got divorced, when the original family got divorced, he didn't own a pest control company. He worked for one. Mm. And he signed a non-compete clause. So he couldn't own a pest control company. But that didn't stop him from taking out a license to do it and then put the whole business in his new wife's name. And, gee, this new business paid for his car and paid for his wife's car. And the new wife was happy to say and testify that she worked full-time in the business and that it was something that she owned and that she ran. And she was happy to support her husband. So he really didn't have much of an income. But, of course, the judge saw through that and attributed it. That income or that to him, and also saw that he didn't have any expenses anymore and used all of that information in modifying and increasing child support. So The lesson learned in that case really, you know, has to do with another issue that is affects so many family-owned businesses in divorce is sort of commingling assets. We've heard, I guess as a lawyer, I've heard about piercing the corporate veil, that there's this, of course, need to maintain a corporate entity and maintain all the proper paperwork and the shareholders' meetings and issuing stock and maintaining corporate formality for different purposes. Well, this is what's so true and crosses the line so often in family-owned businesses and divorces is that so many of their personal expenses are paid through the company. And it's a great device to shelter the family from having to pay taxes or whatever. And it happens so commonly that, you know, this is something that we all know happens. And, you know, so we just expect that. And it has an effect on the value of the business, of course. But when it comes to income, of either parties, because, you know, that's for child support and alimony purposes, we look at their gross income from any source derived, whether it's a self-employment or commissions or capital gains or a property used for the support of the family. And we talk about the income in terms of gross numbers. That's not to say, and I've read through the history of Georgia law, gross income used to mean revenues,
right.
And now it's more carefully defined as, you know, net business income. So
okay.
You get to now deduct your business
expenses.
Well, so they can just run more expenses to reduce the bottom line number.
Correct. Well, that's the easy thing to do. And so then as lawyers, we have to really carefully navigate and talk about what exactly is, you know, a personal expense versus a real business expense. You know, why do you need the company to pay for your car insurance, and all these things that are really normally a personal expense. And when we go through and do that exercise, of course, if you're representing the supported spouse, you want to make sure that income is higher for purposes of determining alimony and child support, ability to pay and whatnot. You also run the risk then of getting audited and having this tax liability come up.
Mm-hmm. What about now? You talked about the case with a pest control company, but I know a lot of family businesses out there are multi-generational. And some of the older generations will start gifting shares of stock, perhaps, to younger generations. Are the same issues going to be at play where, hey, there might be a divorce that's imminent, dad's going to go ahead and start gifting some stock, gifting part of the company to son or daughter? I mean, I guess...
Well, there was a really recent case also, very similar to that, and the husband owned 27% of the stock, maybe something like that. And he was an employee. And the judgment was clear from the Court of Appeals. It articulated that he was paid a reasonable salary for the work that he did. And that they could not prove that his efforts did anything to make the value of the company appreciate in value. And that the value that he contributed, he was already paid through his salary. And he was awarded his stock, and they maintained it as his separate property.
That seems like an issue, too, because he's a minority shareholder.
Perhaps
Correct. If he was a majority shareholder, it might be a different. You could prove that perhaps there was more impact to the appreciation of the business.
True.
Okay. Well, so go back to this. You mentioned something as we were talking about the pure, what Georgia law says. And we're talking about this first piece, this amount during your marriage. It's the appreciation. And you hit upon something, you know, valuation is the hot topic for this component of our discussion. But so most people, when they go into a marriage and they may marry into a business, and to your point, they may have the buy sell, but that they may not have taken a business value, a set in stone, the value of that business, correct? So that all becomes speculated.
Yes, but the buy-sell agreement is a great source to determine, because usually the buy-sell agreement will establish what it will be sold for, or what the value is you're going to receive in the mm-hmm. event of the divorce, or a formula for doing that, or directions for doing that.
Well, a little tip that you probably meant to give that I really heard that I want to make sure our listeners heard is that rather than have this discussion as you're picking out the china and the florist about that you're really changing that discussion not to be about the marriage, but this is a business and we need to take care of some business issues around that, and the buy sell and some of those things will kind of take the sting, if you will, out of the prenup and all of the other things that people avoid.
And I want you to understand that the advice that I would give really, I think, stems from an idea that when you're entering into a marriage, you're both going to contribute something to it, and everybody should get something out of it. It's about providing proper support and providing proper compensation for a marital asset or, based upon needs. Mm-hmm. It's not about trying to, a lot of times people think of a prenuptial agreement as a way to cut people out mm-hmm. from, certain assets. Mm-hmm. And really any contract that you enter into has to have some consideration, and really entering into, and conveying it in such a way that the interest that we want to protect in doing a buy-sell agreement in this way is that we want to protect the control of the company. We want to make sure that the stock ends up in the right hands so that the control is still there. We're not saying you don't receive some value for it or that you shouldn't receive some value for it. Now, if you are saying that, then that's a different discussion, but, that's a discussion you need to have. But if you convey some interest and convey some value for it, then it's a win-win situation, mm-hmm. and it's not such a terrible thing. And mm-hmm. it's saying, welcome to the family. You're going to get some value for it.
Right. That's the spirit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't do what we're talking. We talk about all kinds of planning on this show. And so a lot of people don't plan ahead. They haven't done the right things before. You mentioned, so there's a lot of things that can happen. Let's start talking about what are some of the common mistakes couple make at that point when now they haven't done the pre-planning, and all of a sudden, Tom and Mary decide we are going to need to divorce, and they're looking over the horizon at a family business that's thriving, or in some state in this recession, they might not even be thriving, which is another problem. So where do they begin? They didn't do it right in the first place. What do you see as the common mistakes when people have already made before they walk into your office?
The cleanup,
yeah.
Basically.
Well, mistakes. They continue in a pattern and in a panic. That's the mistake that they make. They go, okay, I'm going to protect my business, but I'm not going to share any information with you. Mm-hmm. Because once you find out, once you go through my paperwork, you're going to, find all the stuff out. So I'm not going to cooperate. I'm not going to give you access to my information. And this is what happens. It plays out in court. You get into court, and the judge wants to listen to the evidence. And the spouse who doesn't have the business says, look at our lifestyle. We've been living this lifestyle. There's money being deposited into our account. We have, fancy cars, fancy houses, but he's showing that he makes only $10,000 a year. It doesn't equate. And he's the one who's in control of, and I'm sorry to say he, but I'm just doing it for Ethan.
Right.
It happens the other way around, believe me. What happened to this? And so the judge turns to the moneyed spouse and says, show me the money. Where is this coming from? And when they say, it's not there, they don't believe them. And that's like the number one thing in family court. The number one asset we have is our credibility.
Right.
And you automatically lose it. And because it's so common in family-owned businesses to commingle assets and stuff, unfortunately, the person who owns the business automatically walks into court with a lack of credibility. It's just assumed that you're going to not be forthcoming and that you've kind of commingled your things. And you have that burden, not literally, not legally, but practically you do, in order to come forward with all that information and trace it and show this is where all the money is, here's the information. So the best thing they can do is say, come look at all of my paperwork. Be honest about all the personal expenses. Show, help them navigate through all the businesses or through all the general ledgers and everything so that they give them any information they want. And so when they come to court, you can say, no, this is what it is. This is the information I provided. Honestly, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And you have to prove with documentation that what you're saying is correct.
So the greater the transparency, the more credibility they're going to have walking in the door.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
What if, let me take another kind of, and I know you're going to go through some scenarios, but a scenario that comes to my mind, and I've seen some cases like this with some of my clients, is where non-working spouse ends up having to get a portion. She becomes a minority shareholder in this family-owned business, doesn't want anything to do with it, but gets the dividend, essentially, that the family is not pleased about having to pay out, and they weren't looking to have this business partner, and clearly they didn't do the right operations and buy-sell agreements up front. What are the options? Is it, where are they getting the money to do the buyout, or how would that work?
Well, now we're talking about sort of financing issues, whether you're going to borrow money to pay it out, whether you're going to sell off shares if you can, sell the company to pay it off, whether it comes from ongoing income. That's something that it's a big question. How is that going to happen? And there are different ways that it comes down. Most judges, I believe, judges would do this because they're familiar enough with ongoing issues in divorce to sever the party's relationship as much as they can, and to not have that commingle, not to continue that kind of relationship where you get a percentage of the stock.
So it'd be kind of the last asset, essentially, that non-working spouse would get.
But I want you to realize that juries, on the other hand, think that's so easy. Because the juries will try to take the easy way out. And, well, just give her 50% or just give her that percentage and let them work out the rest of the details. And all it takes is one person, one party to demand a jury. And if one party demands it, they get it. Okay? And so that's one of the big risks of going forward, is that juries are going to want to do that. And then let's say you pay out, because then the controlling spouse, the one who controls the interest or the family, for example, can control what dividends are being paid out, however their business acumen is, whatever they decide to do. And so then you're ending up with a scenario where the other spouse, who's entitled to a percentage or whatever, wants an accounting. And believe me, they can come back and sue the company in order to enforce that and get an accounting and enforce their shareholder rights. And that's what I've seen happen in subsequent cases when that does happen.
They can just pay it all out in salary and not have a dividend, and the family gets paid, and
easily.
She's stuck
without it.
Yeah, a minority interest and no income to supplement that.
Right.
Wow. Well, it sounds like...
How you look?
I know.
Shocked
this is,
and appalled.
No. I mean, I've been in a family business torn apart by a divorce. So I do know that. It's just when you listen, what you hear, Tamar, what you said in your opening introduction really needs to be reiterated here, which is, you're sitting down with that. First of all, you're pre-planning, and hopefully some of these stories will make our listeners realize how important it is. But secondly, this idea of sitting down with your client and saying, what is it that you really hope? And what I also heard, which is where this kind of gets mired in otherwise, is looking ahead. What do you want your life to be going forward?
Right. And so for the non-moneyed spouse, I want them to have money.
Right.
As opposed to, a share of a business or an asset they can go after. I just want them to have cash in that sense. Or maybe we want to value the company and award them assets that are equivalent in value. And so that one party can keep the whole value of the business, keep it all on one side, and the other side gets more retirement funds or the marital residence or something else, and which is more common. That I see.
Well, that speaks to a common theme that we have in almost every show is privately held family businesses. The majority of their assets tend to be in this privately held stock. Maybe they have some real estate. There's not a lot of liquidity. And we've talked about it in the cases of death and disability and buyouts. And here we are again with divorce. If there aren't a lot of assets that aren't liquid, it gets very tough, it sounds like, to be able to do these buyouts and address the split.
Right. But there's always financing options available. I mean, that payout can be paid out as equitable division over time. It doesn't have to be a lump sum, but it could be done over time, and that can be financed by the company, or and it can be secured by assets in the company if that's what, you know, we're able to do. It could also be additional alimony payments, depending on, you know, what type of business it is. So instead of a normal alimony amount, it could be a higher amount. It could, the alimony could be for a longer period of time. It could be that instead of it being terminable at the remarriage or death of the party, that it's a certain amount to represent that asset in the company, which is actually, you know, there's tax benefits to doing it as alimony, because then the person paying it gets a tax deduction for that distribution, and mm-hmm. and the other spouse has more liquid cash for a longer period of time. And alimony is somewhat easier to collect mm-hmm. than some of the other options.
Exactly. You know, we keep talking about kind of the spouse on the outside, but have you ever seen or had some case law regarding, you know, we're both running the business and something's happened and we're not going to continue the marriage, clearly, but both people don't want to give up the business. They want to continue to function together in the business. Can that happen?
It does. There's two cases that came to my mind. One, I had a family business, and they were so intertwined. I mean, there was an adulterous affair involved, but they really needed each other, and she needed the business to continue to help support her because she wasn't working anywhere else, and she was getting the most value for her whatever she was contributing. I mean, mm-hmm. she was doing more of accounting and other issues, but she wouldn't get paid the same amount working anywhere else. And he was much older and in developing the business and wanted to transfer the business over to her in a way to maintain that he can continue getting support from her when he can no longer function. He really wanted to do that, but they were ready to get divorced. And so we did. We were able to create some sort of employment contract and transfer of shares over a period of time with that intention in mind. Another case, that was a settlement, though. That was something that was carefully negotiated. And it really, really, really spoke to what their goals were and what they really needed mm-hmm. as opposed to what the law said, because nothing that we did was defined anywhere by Georgia law on that one.
Well, every case sounds like it's so different, and you really have to craft results based upon what the client's issues are.
Absolutely. Now, there's another case. I used to clerk for Judge Dempsey in Fulton County Superior Court, and there was a case that he heard while I was a law clerk, and it involved the an advertising business. And it was, they did this one ad that was very successful, and the wife was the actual actress in this commercial that was just such a, I think it was Longhorn Steakhouse. It was like she was the one. And they knew they were getting divorced. And they didn't want, but they wanted to work together because they were such a successful team. The judge incorporated what they were at. They were both asking for that in terms of distributing, you know, the business and how to make it work. I don't recall exactly what the terms were, but yeah. I just remember that it was memorable that they wanted to continue working together.
Right. I can see that. You know, we sent the fear of God into everybody when we said that one person can ask for a jury and the jury's going to see this differently. So
give her half the business.
Yeah, so
no big deal.
I can absolutely see that in the wrong county, in the wrong time, on the wrong day that happens. Talk about that. How do you go at this process to help to mitigate the chances that you're going to wind up? I mean, understood that sometimes you have no control, but what can you do to try to mitigate that you're going to wind up in front of a jury instead of a judge that understands where to look for the cash?
Juries often cost a lot of money, and there's always a risk on both sides in order, in going in front of a jury. But, you know, juries sometimes, you know, when you want, when you have the side of the case where you want to do something simple and you have a good sound bite and the other side is a real bad person and they, you know, you want, you have entertaining facts, adultery or whatever, you know, that will keep a jury entertained, then really it's about having a really good lawyer who can handle that appropriately and can handle it on both sides, I mean, defend against it. If there are complicated valuation issues and complicated tracing issues and all that stuff, the jury's not going to, you know, typically stay awake for all of it. And so you have to have talented experts and talented lawyers in order to cull it down into a simple form and to entertain the jury.
I can see the forensic CPAs hard at work on some of these family business cases. I would assume from these expense issues.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit. It always comes up as a topic. We encourage our listeners always to have a team. That trusted advisors, you know, working together, pulled together as a team, as opposed to either A, in isolation, or B, not really having the full complement. So, in your practice, as you're working with a family business owner and all these issues are coming up, what does that team look like? Yeah, obviously, a forensic CPA at some point in time. What else?
In terms of dealing with the business?
Yeah. So what other partners do you bring in as other trusted advisors that work along you as you're working with your clients?
It could be a number of different people, depending on what the issues are. Mm-hmm. But they have their own accountants usually. They have their own financial advisors usually. I like to use a forensic accountant as a neutral party that both parties can agree on using, and usually that works very well because there's just one expert who can really give us all good advice and arguments on both sides so that we're kind of talking about the same numbers and talking about it honestly. Although unless you've agreed in writing that we're not going to go to court or that we aren't going to, you know, use this person for everything, I've had it blow up in my face where, you know, they don't agree, and then we end up going to court and having to hire a new expert. So sometimes you are going to have that neutral person who might be able to come in and help negotiate, but then you're going to have to go and hire out an expert just for the purpose of testifying. I've also used an occupational therapist who can come in and assess what the value of a person.
Like ability to earn income.
Ability to earn, yeah, based upon what they are educated and what their experiences are and what their income capacity is. We're going to use a business evaluator also. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're all the same people, but.
right. But knowing that for our listeners, that having a good team is going to give you the most expertise in each individual area.
And we're also, when we're evaluating the business, a lot of times the CPA that we've hired to either do the forensic accounting and appraisal of the business isn't qualified to appraise the assets of the business. So we might have to also hire additional appraisers depending on what the business is about.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something blowing up in your face, and we talked a little bit about this, all of us, at one point in time. You know, sometimes people start out down the road of mediation, or we had a show many months ago about going to a collaborative practice, which does require more contractual. But a lot of people get into mediation, and there isn't any contract that says this is the way we're going to resolve that. And it would seem like that would be a good thing to have if somebody starts down that road.
Yeah, I do. I agree. It is, especially when you're talking about using a lot of experts. The traditional way is for you to have in a divorce or in any legal action is to have two sides competing and wanting to present their evidence as best case for their side. So we have competing experts. It costs twice as much money in order to do that. And so an obvious, and it's not just, you know, coming out of the business. It's coming out of both pockets. It's coming from the marital assets. It's all going to experts as opposed to, you know, saving money for college education or for, you know, food and shelter and everything else that you need. And so that's usually the mutual reason why, you know, we convince clients to not spend all that money that way, because you're just taking money away from the marital estate. But eventually, the idea being that if you can't all agree to use one person, that is what's going to happen. You mm-hmm. are going to have competing experts. Right. And so it's nice to be able to cut it off and agree. So in order to agree, you have to have two people who are willing to. Mm-hmm. And, as, and, you know, just whenever you just have one person who's saying, yeah, let's do it this way, but the other person isn't willing to agree, that's, you know.
And we know
while the tab is rolling.
Right. Well, and we know that if there was tremendous level of agreement, they probably wouldn't be in the offices in the first place. So there's a challenge. You know, we've talked a lot here about, you know, one spouse continuing on with the business and the other person getting paid out. But I don't know if you've seen any of this, but it would seem like another inevitable income is that the business winds up going down in flames in the middle of this, trying to finance the divorce and finance the buyout and finance all of that. Is that something that you've seen?
Yes. I've seen it always hurt the person who owns the business mm-hmm. in the end. Mm-hmm. It's hard to distinguish between a business that truly goes out of business because of the economy or whatever versus somebody who's maybe suppressing their income, not working as hard, doing it on purpose. And judges are always going to be suspect of that. Mm-hmm. And so even though, I mean, the law says that if you have an involuntary loss of income or if your income or financial status has changed, that's a basis for modifying child support or alimony. So you have to prove that it wasn't voluntary. And that's hard to prove sometimes. And just in reviewing the cases, maybe one out of all the ones I've seen did the business spouse, the one who's running the business, get the benefit of it. Usually that kind of request is denied. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can, you know, certainly tear employees apart. I was kind of tied up in that, but I can also see that just the drain on finances, especially in a industry in this precarious economy, it wouldn't take much.
And that's true. It might be hard. It's going to be hard on both sides, meaning that with a bad economy, incomes are going to go down. They're going to want to modify and reduce income. At the same time, the other side isn't going to get their alimony or child support paid, and they're going to want to hold them in contempt. And what we're seeing is that neither is happening. You know, you don't right. get your modification because even though your business may be failing, the question is, why are you still doing it? Why aren't you going out and to try to find something else? You still have an obligation that you have to pay. Right. These kids need to eat. Yeah, mm-hmm. things still need to happen. It's just that you may not get the money. You know, the other side, you may not be put in jail mm-hmm. for not paying.
Yay.
But. but you can't say to the judge, but you don't understand, this business is my life. It, that's not going to cut it.
Not that I've seen.
Yeah.
Well, and the other side, too, is I think when you have a dynamic like that going on in a family business, it can't be good for the employees there. It can't do anything but hurt the value of the company in terms of affecting sales, revenues. So I keep trying to look at an upside on that, and I'm not seeing it unless you have an existing spouse that has partial ownership and trying to get them out.
Don't get me wrong. I get lots of spouses who I sit there and go, let's go get them. You know, this is so clearly a contempt. Let's go garnish. And they're just like, no, I don't want to rock their they're having a hard time. I want to make sure that their business continues. I want to make sure that they're in the best place they can be in order for them to work hard. I understand it's hard now, and I'm not going to say anything now. I'll even waive interest that is owed or whatever, because they see the value in making sure that the business owned, you know, the spouse who owns the business can, you know, continue to function and focus their energies on making money as opposed to defending in court.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've kind of talked about some of the obvious things that people think about, and it comes, you know, the what do we do with the business and that. Any other cases that you saw that are a little bit more off the beaten path, but probably good to remember because one never knows what one's going to be involved in?
I'm trying to go over. We really, what I see mostly is where the assets are and expense, personal expenses are really paid out through the company. Going into court, I've seen juries and even sometimes judges, you know, not like a spouse because they're hiding information, because their credibility just wasn't what it should be. And they end up awarding assets of the business or even parts of the business to the other spouse, almost in spite, you know, but that's they think that this is what's fair. Understand that the you can always appeal the divorce, but the standard of review in appeal is if there's any evidence to support the verdict, it'll get affirmed. Mm-hmm. And that's the horror story that I've seen is some really bad results happening and being affirmed on appeal. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, if it was really fair results, we won't necessarily see those decisions being appealed. We see the really bad ones,
right.
But what you need to know is that they're very difficult to overturn. I think the most interesting issues coming forward I just want to let you know, just the audience know, I did a survey recently of all the Georgia law case law regarding businesses and divorce. I came up with about 80 cases out of all for the last 200 years. I mean, I was just 200. Yeah, I mean, it really isn't that many.
Right.
And what you need to know is that. Divorces weren't automatically appealable. You have to get permission from the Supreme Court. And recently, within the last 10 years or so, that the Supreme Court has a pilot project that accepted all divorce appeals. Okay, so we're now getting many more decisions from the Supreme Court regarding divorces. And what we haven't heard a lot about recently is what appropriate valuations, what appropriate relief is available to parties going through a divorce with businesses. We haven't had a lot of cases on that, and I'm excited that we are going to start seeing more and more of that. You know, there are different standards for valuing businesses. There's certain different standards for depending on what the business is. If it's just a service-oriented business versus a sales-oriented, whether it's a professional business like, you know, a dentist or you know, I was talking to my hairdresser. Mm-hmm. You know, what if, you know, we valued your business and then gave a half of it to your spouse, and the hairdresser's sitting there going, well, but it's just me, you know, how do we distinguish goodwill or an established value on a business versus just a source of income for alimony purposes?
Right.
And so those are the issues that I hope to see out of the Supreme Court.
What happens if we have one of our listeners, say it's a family business owner and they're contemplating divorce? And they own the business. What are some things that they can be thinking about doing to kind of get their ducks in a row, so to speak, so that they're not up the creek, basically, if and when they decide to go ahead and file?
Well, I'm not sure that it's ever really too late. You can do a postnuptial agreement. I think that if you go to your business attorney and say, this is what we've got, what do you recommend? And they say, oh, buy-sell agreement. Make it part of your estate planning. You know, you don't have to approach it in terms of getting a divorce, but more of as a whole estate plan as to what to do with it. Do hire somebody to do a valuation of your business and go through and audit how you spend your money. I'm not necessarily saying that you have to change how you do things, although, of course, as a lawyer, I want to recommend, you know, you want to make sure you've got your stock certificates and your corporate documents in order and know what is likely to be attributable as your income so that you've got all of your documents and all your ducks in a row when it comes forward and planning it.
And not until they have all those things done do they need to give Tamara a call. Is that right?
Well, they can ahead of time. I'll just give them more specific information.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be perfect?
Yeah.
Well, I think it still comes back to there's still one question that you ask that I don't think is common, which is, okay, what do you want to do going forward? And I would think that would take some of the acrimony away too, because, you know, we talk about this when people are when they're going to sell their business, the most success comes when they think ahead as to what they're going to do once the business is sold. And so same thing kind of goes with the divorce.
Yeah, I mean, this is a life thing. I mean, in terms of how you are most effective as a person in life, right? And what you know, in terms of fulfilling your values and what your mission is as a human being, and you know, it's all part of the same thing. You're always going to be more successful when you have a goal in mind that fulfills your values and you have plan steps in order to make that happen. And so, I mean, you mentioned me about, you talk about me like focusing on what people want. A lot of time, and that's what I do in my first meeting with any client, is ask them that question, and then I tell them I don't really expect an answer because you haven't thought about it enough, or you may not have thought about it enough. And I really want to educate them as to what the possibilities are, sort of plant seeds in their brain. I want to educate them on the laws so that they know what will happen if we go to court or what likely may happen or what the risks are. And when you equip yourself with information and education, then you're going to come up with a better idea about what makes sense and then really what matters to you in the end result. You know, having the most toys at the end of the game, or you know, making sure that your kids are healthy and well taken care of and educated appropriately and have good relationships with their family members. You know, it's kind of an obvious thing because no one is going to come into my office and say, "No, I'd rather have." You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, don't worry about the money.
Well, but it's asking the question in this case of how healthy do you want? You know, you've helped build this business. What do you want for the business going forward as much as you want for the children? And when they start to look at it from that point of view, it can take some of that punishment mentality off of the table.
Right. And we really look toward, and that's the good lesson, is that ultimately when you're focused on the right things, then all the other messy stuff that nobody likes to talk about usually goes away. And we really focus, and it's easier to negotiate and get a result that you like, that fulfills what you want and your goals, your real goals, when you can, you know, get down to the nitty-gritty and look at what's important.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Tamara, it sounds like anybody walking through your doors is going to get a lot of good counsel and a lot of good support. We have a point in our show where we ask our guests, you know, what are three tips if you could, if everybody listening could be a potential client, what do you want to tell them, best tips when approaching this subject so that we can share this as on our archives?
Well, I mean, the first and most important thing I think I've already said, I'm really summarizing, is to educate yourself on the law as what's applicable to your situation so that you know what's at risk if you go to trial, and to know that there's a lot at risk. And the second thing would be just to really make sure that you're maintaining your credibility throughout the process. If you need to, fix it, you know, and get everything, all your documentation and whatnot in order so that you can build your credibility and maintain it throughout the process. And the last thing really is to, you know, really be able, once you know those things, kind of try to plan ahead and prepare and, you know, do what you can either with regard to protect, you know, what's important either through prenuptial, postnuptial, buy-sell agreements, estate plans, that sort of thing.
Wonderful. Well, we appreciate you coming on today.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's great information. And Tamara, if somebody wants to follow up with you, how can they reach you directly, and what website would they go to?
Well, they can call me right now at 404-846-2001. The website is easy to remember, www.georgia-law.com.
Excellent. And for our listeners, you can go to our website, which is www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. And up there you will see Tamara's background and her contact information, and it's all clicked through, so you can easily reach it there. And if you go back to that site in a couple of days, actually about Tuesday of next week, you will be able to download this podcast if you would like to listen to it and make some notes so that you actually do have your ducks in a row when you need to. And otherwise, we ask you to come back here at 1 o'clock next Thursday for another edition of Family Business Radio. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.